This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Mara Verhaden Hilliard joins us from Washington, D.C. Mara has been in the streets defending protesters for years and gives us an up-to-date account of what she's witnessed.
The American people have risen up for the last 2 weeks against not just police violence and senseless police murder, but really against the whole situation that has shown that the ruling elites in the United States are incapable of defending our population. We talked with Paul Jay, the editor of the News Analysis, about what we can do about this extraordinary situation.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last week, Donald Trump announced his readiness to deploy the military to enforce order inside the United States. From the Rose Garden, he vowed that if city and state leaders did not, quote, take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, he would invoke the 1807 Insurrection Act. It allows a president to deploy the military to suppress civil disorder. In response, defense officials have expressed discomfort at the prospect of calling in active duty troops to police protected First Amendment activity. Many have emphasized the importance of having local law enforcement take charge. Some National Guard troops are also reportedly wary of the move, even as more are mobilized domestically. Army Major General Thomas Carden of the Georgia National Guard told reporters, quote, I believe that we in America should not get used to or accept uniformed service members of any variety having to be put in a position where they are having to secure people inside the United States of America. He also said, quote, while we're glad to do it and honored to do it, this is a sign of the times that we need to do better as a country. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is attorney Mara Verhaden Hilliard with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Mara is one of the nation's preeminent authorities on the policing of First Amendment-protected activities, including the right to peaceably assemble and associate. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Mara, take a listen to this clip from Donald Trump's Rose Garden announcement and tell us what your reaction was when you first heard it.
That is why I am taking immediate presidential action to stop the violence and restore security and safety in America. I am mobilizing all available federal resources, civilian and military, to stop the rioting and looting, to end the destruction and arson, and to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans, including your Second Amendment rights. Therefore, the following measures are going into effect immediately. First, we are ending the riots and lawlessness that has spread throughout our country. We will end it now. Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them. I am also taking swift and decisive action to protect our great capital, Washington, D.C. What happened in this city last night was a total disgrace. As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property. We are putting everybody on warning. Our 7 o'clock curfew will be strictly enforced.
We heard Donald Trump come out onto the streets of Washington, D.C., and announced to the people of the United States that he essentially wants to place them under militarized control. And it was a very ominous and threatening speech. It was intended to be ominous and threatening. And it says everything about his presidency and about how he views his role. It also says a lot about his extreme weakness at this moment, because you have people across the United States who are rising up and making it clear that they're not going to tolerate racial injustice, social injustice, that they're going to fight for the world that they want to live in. And he really sounded like a little dictator.
Mara, we heard rumors in the midst of the COVID pandemic that something like this would happen, but I think many of us thought it was not a possibility. But as a resident of the nation's capital and someone who has worked on policing issues and instituted with others in D.C. reforms about how police treat protesters, did you expect Trump to take really this ultimate and rarely taken step in the face of national peaceful protests?
I think given the magnitude of the protests and the threat that those protests are, and I don't mean threat as in threat of violence, I mean threat to the established political order, it is not surprising that this administration would want to threaten people who are engaged in peaceful First Amendment activity, that he would want to make a show of military force. And what we're experiencing in Washington here, where I'm based and where I am a resident, is really a testing ground for a militarization. The streets here are filled with National Guard. We have had just these vicious assaults on peaceful protesters and journalists. As of yesterday, we have 1,600 troops who are amassed just outside of Washington. That's the 82nd Airborne, the 1st Division. And this is really a president who feels that militarization and total control of the American people is the only way that he can manage.
Let's clarify the role of those deployed from those different parts of the National Guard and Army. I understand that they can't perform law enforcement duties such as arrest and detention of protesters. Does that change under the Insurrection Act? And am I even correct in that assumption?
When the military, in the rare circumstance where a military deployment is made on domestic soil, it is supposed to be defense support for civilian authorities. So the idea is that they are providing support, but the lead of person-to-person contact is police authorities with civilians. I can't speak to what Barr or General Milley or Donald Trump think that they're doing, or the Secretary of Defense with these deployments. There is no question that this is happening because of the powerful movement that's growing in the United States and is unstoppable. And, you know, I want to also say that for all of his threats and his ominous tone, it truly backfired on him. And they came out, they were gassing people, shooting them with stinger grenades and, we believe, rubber bullets. And what happened as a result of that is that the next day, there were even more people who came. So while often we would see mass police repression would have the impact of making people afraid and making them stay inside, we're seeing a shift in the consciousness of people. And many people who came out, there were maybe 10,000 people out in front of the White House the day after, many more people who came, were saying that a lot of them actually hadn't been out in the streets before. But as people across the country are seeing not only the injustice, but the police repression against people fighting for justice, they've decided where they want to stand in history. And people are coming out in larger and larger numbers. So all the threats from the administration and the arming and occupation of Washington, D.C., and the threats to do so in other cities, it's having the opposite effect on people.
That's so interesting to hear, Mara. You know, I remember when you and I were working on mass defense issues at the National Lawyers Guild 10, 15 years ago, we used to say the visible militarized use of force against peaceful protesters by law enforcement could have a deterrent effect on people who wanted to come out at that time to protest policies of the George W. Bush administration. So this, with all the images that we're seeing on national television and on the internet of police wielding lethal weaponry against passive protesters, that is such heartening news to see. Now, I just want to follow up. I read that the Pentagon has denied using rubber bullets against D.C. protesters. So was that local law enforcement that did?
Well, there have been multiple incidents across the district, and we have many different jurisdictions operating. The incident that occurred directly in front of the White House when the forces moved forward like a paramilitary operation against peaceful protesters and against journalists just so Donald Trump could have his photo op in front of the church hanging onto a Bible. It does not appear that the D.C. police were in the lines of officers who were sweeping and shooting at people. But there was National Guard, there were Park Police, and there were Secret Service. So whether it was the Pentagon, there were all these other agencies who were there and who were shooting and gassing people. They're also using stinger grenades, which, as your audience may or may not know, they look like hand grenades, and when they explode, they can have multiple elements to them. They can have sound, they can have smoke, but they shoot out these rubber pellets that cause significant damage. They can put people's eyes out. There are people who, from this incident, have been like seriously wounded. They have pellet cuts, burns, you know, and it's like little mini bullets all over their lower extremities.
That's vicious. That's similar to bullets that break up into numerous pieces when they hit the target. Mara, how does this rash of police violence against peaceful protesters everywhere around the nation, but especially in D.C., go against the revised police procedures and policies that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund was central in bringing about a decade ago?
They're clearly violating the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act when it comes to the D.C. police on D.C. jurisdiction. You know, it's like when you're in front of the White House, you could be standing in Lafayette Park, and that would be the Park Police jurisdiction, and you could take one step onto Pennsylvania Avenue or H Street, suddenly you're on someone else's jurisdiction. So depending on where you're standing, there are different rules and laws in play. However, the District of Columbia Police are required to abide by the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act, which has very significant restrictions on illegal police conduct. And when they work in mutual aid with any other agency, those agencies are to be given copies of the law and instructed on their requirement to abide by those rules as well. We additionally have had agreements as a result of our litigation with federal police, with the Park Police, who also have very explicit requirements about when they can take actions against a group and about orders to disperse. Those were plainly violated when they just began assaulting people. There were officers on horseback just coming at people, followed by lines of other officers who were shooting at people. All of that is being violated. And while the D.C. police and the mayor here are trying to kind of keep their distance and throw up their hands and shrug and say, well, you know, we're under the gun and we're not responsible for what the federal police are doing and we're the good guys. The truth is the D.C. police also have been engaged in mass violations of civil rights. There was an incident that same night where they attacked and corralled and kettled a group of young people, predominantly young African-American people who were peacefully marching. And even though there was a curfew, but they were not engaged in anything but lawful First Amendment activity, which in our mind anyway would be an exemption from curfew restrictions. But they kettled them, and they the young people were demanding to be let go. the police were pepper spraying them, were beginning to attack them with batons, and residents on this block down in sort of the DuPont Circle, Logan area, opened their doors. One man in particular allowed about 70 young people to run inside, and he kept them there all night while the police were trying to get in, and he protected them through the night. It was really something about solidarity.
Mara, talk briefly about the psychological impact of armed police and riot gear at these mass assemblies and protests.
Well, the impact, as you were saying before, you know, we see time and again that there's a twofold, I think, intentional impact. One is the repression and suppression of speech of people who are out speaking their mind at that moment. And the other is the intention to send a message to the public that engaging in First Amendment protected, cherished rights, those activities are potentially criminal, that they look dangerous. And the idea is to keep protests from growing, to keep people who are inside who might otherwise agree with the sentiment of a demonstration from joining a demonstration, either at that moment or as days go on, if a demonstration is persistent, to keep people from coming out. But that's the very interesting thing that we're seeing right now and right here. I mean, there's no question that that kind of action is chilling people in some regard. There is certainly going to be some number of people who might really want to join a protest but feel like, you know, they're risking life and limb to do so, even if they have only expectations of peaceful, nonviolent activity. The police, as we see, are attacking nonviolent protesters constantly. But the numbers are showing that in the aggregate, more and more people are coming out, and that the actual attack from the police is making people feel that they have to stand up for the society that they believe in, that they have to stand up for the right of people to demand change, and that they want to be part of that. So it is, in fact, causing many people to feel that they're fighting for, racial justice, against police brutality, and for the right to speak itself. And that's amazing that we're seeing just more and more people. Like right now, there are people in the streets in Washington who are coming out, you know, for yet one more day. And this is in the face of more and more troops. We have hundreds of troops right now. We have military helicopters overhead. There was an Osprey this morning. It is extraordinary, the images that we're seeing of these masked up anonymous military all over the Lincoln Memorial occupying it. It's like something that we have never seen in Washington, D.C., except perhaps when Eisenhower came in with MacArthur to clear the bonus armies.
That's truly incredible. Speaking of things that we haven't seen as much, talk briefly about police provocateurs. When I checked out a protest a few days ago in New York City, I saw by the sidelines several undercover officers, and I must say they've upped their game in terms of their garb. They're not as easy to recognize. But I've heard, as we always do, of incidents of police dressing like protesters and then not only monitoring individuals, but actually fomenting trouble. Do you think that's going on now?
I don't think there can be any doubt that there are police provocateurs in different places who are taking actions intended to justify a repressive police response. And I'm sure many people watch the video of what's being called the Umbrella Man in Minneapolis at the AutoZone. There are a lot of images of people that don't seem to be connected with anyone else and that are taking actions that appear to be against the interest of a crowd at a particular moment. We do know that historically the police, pose as protesters and do take provocative acts, and it's been documented time and time again, because it gives the police a justification for a very significant crackdown, and even though we wouldn't say it's a legal justification to attack a group at all because of the actions of any person or individuals, to go after an entire group of people who are engaged in lawful activity because somebody else engages in non-lawful activity is, unconstitutional. But the police are looking for these moments where they can say, oh, now the crowd is something different, and now we have justification for a mass assault.
Let's talk about the contrast between the murder of George Floyd and other African American men at the hands of police, and racial injustice and property damage. I know in New York, many small shop owners who sustain minor property damage are standing strong with protesters and calling for justice, not only for the Floyd family, but all other African American victims of police brutality. What does that say to you?
I've seen the same thing, not just in New York. We saw it in Washington, D.C., where some owners of businesses and restaurants put out really powerful statements about, you know, obviously distraught at, you know, what can happen to their own businesses, but also saying very clearly that broken windows have nothing compared to 400 years of institutionalized racism and police killings. And I think that really sums up an extraordinary shift in our society, where we're endlessly told that, you know, broken windows are the ultimate sign of the destruction of our society, but not the killing of human beings. And people are really, the consciousness is shifting among many in America who now are understanding, people who haven't been subject to this kind of brutality, but now are recognizing what the reality is for so many other people and are standing up in opposition. And that's a sea change for this country. And I think says so much about the trajectory that we're on right now that is not going to be stopped.
Mara, can there be legal challenges in court in the time of COVID to the orchestrated clampdown on First Amendment protected activities?
Of course, because the First Amendment stands no matter what. Donald Trump cannot suspend the First Amendment. No one can suspend our Constitution in this fashion, no matter what they try and do. In fact, at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, we're doing a lot of legal work right now. We're defending people. We're providing movement support. We're doing everything we can to strengthen this movement, to help the movement, and to defend First Amendment rights. And so there is no question, incursions on the First Amendment and efforts to strip people of these fundamental rights will be challenged. No one, not we, not others around the country, are going to let that happen.
In our remaining few minutes, is there anything, Mara, that we haven't touched on that you'd like to tell our listeners?
You know, most of the listeners of Law and Disorder are, you know, progressive people who care deeply about justice. That's why they listen to your wonderful show. And I'm sure have been in the streets. It's a difficult time for many because obviously many people, too, are being very, very careful and, you know, don't want to risk getting sick. I know I've seen at the demonstrations there's often a couple layers of people. There will be a lot of people who maybe feel at greater risk. And almost everyone I've seen has masks on, and sometimes there are people who are standing like a little further back trying to keep distance where you can keep distance. It's obviously a really, really tough and a really difficult time. But I think the thing is, everything we're facing in every single day is showing that this is an unstoppable moment. This is one of these inflection points for us as a people. And it's one of those times in history where everything that we do matters. I think for people, for my generation and younger than me, this may be the first time in our lifetimes that we've seen something happening so significant on such a level as this, that it could cause the extraordinary change in our society that has to happen. And we feel it, and certainly the establishment powers feel it, and, you know, those that don't want that change are going to do everything they can to stop it. But the momentum of the people and the demands of the people are so absolute and so strong, and people are so united in such extraordinary solidarity that it's clear that the people are unstoppable.
Mara, how can people learn more about the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund's work, and how can they get involved?
We would encourage people to come to justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline.org, and sign up for alerts and updates. And also, you can come to our Twitter page, which is at the PCJF. That's at the PCJF. And people can join with us. They can get alerts from us. They can participate in actions. And I would urge everyone to find an organization that says things that you care about, any organization that you believe in that is deeply involved in this movement, and join with that organization, because there's nothing like being organized and being with a group of people who are like-minded and participating and not feeling like you're isolated. There's a mass movement out there, and everyone should be part of it.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, we applaud the work that you have been doing now for over two decades to keep people safe in the street and to preserve our First Amendment-protected activities. Be safe out there, and thank you so much.
Thank you, and you take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The police murder of George Floyd triggered a nationwide popular explosion, the likes of which the ruling elites of America have never endured since the founding of the USA as a settler colonial state 244 years ago. The rebellion against police violence comes in the context of 40 million people being unemployed in a pandemic which has sickened 1.5 million people, killing over 100,000 of them. The plague has brought about a depression in the economy, which will go on for many years, leaving people unemployed, uninsured, hungry, and homeless. As always, the most advanced sector of the population in the USA is the African-American population, but there has been an unprecedented amount of solidarity expressed between Americans of all races and ages. Although we do not yet have a leadership with sufficient clarity, organization, and strength, we must view the development of the rebellion as a process. Will demand for community control of the police unfold more generally into a demand for a more just society with the democratic control of the economy? That, of course, is the big question. We are joined today by Paul Jay, the founder and editor of the Analysis.News. He's a journalist, filmmaker, and the founder of Real News. He is currently working with Daniel Ellsberg on a documentary series based on Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. We will discuss the kind of movement that is needed to reverse the nuclear arms race, as well as bring about the democratic organization of our society and economy. Paul Jay, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for inviting me.
Paul, we're going to talk today about Trump's pulling out of the international treaties designed to limit the possibility of nuclear war and the $1 trillion he and Obama before him plan to spend over the next 30 years revamping America's nuclear arsenal. But before we get into this, let's talk about the rebellion that started last week. You covered the situation in Baltimore after the murder of Freddie Gray. What do you make of what's going on nationwide now after the murder of George Floyd?
Well, I'm not in Baltimore now or in one of the cities that things are exploding. I got away from New York because of the coronavirus. But I have a sense of what's going on because of having been in Baltimore through the whole Freddie Gray experience. The thing that's being missed, I guess, in the way corporate media covers all of this is they pay a bit of lip service to the issue of poverty and racism, but they don't ever ask why. Why is there chronic poverty in these cities? Why is the systemic racism? They'll even use those words these days. I saw Hillary Clinton, I think, actually use the word systemic racism. But it's a complete abstraction, the way they talk about systemic racism, because systemic racism isn't some virus. It's not a COVID-19. Systemic racism is an outgrowth of a capitalism that developed out of a slave society. It's the ideology of slavery. And it's still in exists today because the kind of slavery, outright slavery, that existed back when the United States was a slave system doesn't exist except in the prison system, where it essentially does exist. But what there exists now is a pool of extremely cheap labor in most of the big American cities. And it's very, very profitable for the corporations and nonprofit corporations, I have to say as well, because in Baltimore, it's places like Johns Hopkins Hospital, which on the face of it is a nonprofit, but it operates like a nonprofit. And they take advantage of this cheap labor. And that is the underlying reason why there's still systemic racism. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't in the culture, permeating the culture, racist ideas. And one of the points of the racist ideology in the first place, white supremacy, was to get sections of the white working class to buy into the idea that somehow they weren't so bad off because at least they were better than the black workers. And they tried to use this racist ideology to divide people. And that's still a role it plays today. But what's going on now in the streets is obviously a reflection of the burning, raging anger of people who live in deep poverty. And I think there's a nuance to this, which I don't think gets talked about enough, which is the police brutality. It's not as simple as they're just some racist police who hate people with black skin. The system of systemic racism, the system of keeping people in poverty for the sake of having a pool of cheap labor, the culture of the police departments, which have very much the inheritors of a culture of the early police forces that went and captured escaped slaves. But all that's perpetuated because this need for the elites, and then very misguidedly sections of white workers who think they're better off, but the need to keep people in poverty and then restrain them when they fight back. And sometimes that fighting back is political. And these days, more often than not, it's very self-destructive. A lot of the fighting back, a lot of the murder and mayhem that goes on in poor neighborhoods is poor blacks against poor blacks. And that's the product of desperation from living in such conditions. And the police role, I saw this in Baltimore, is to contain the consequences of poverty within the neighborhoods that are super poor. So if you were a white person in Baltimore, it was one of the safest places you could be. I know in 2019, I think there was something like 348 murders in Baltimore. I don't have the exact statistic, but it's something in the range of about 97% of those murders were black-on-black murders, and a large amount of it domestic violence that gets portrayed in the media as if it's mostly gang. And certainly there is some gang violence, but a lot of it is just people cracking under the pressure of living with horrible economic anxiety, not knowing if they're going to be able to feed their kids at the end of every month. I think it's very interesting what's happening now with the COVID crisis, that whole sections of the white working class that thought everything was okay are now being thrown into poverty themselves and never imagined it would happen. And I think that's to a large extent going to change the politics. But cops are the visible sign of a system. And a lot of the rage against the police brutality is too much in my mind focusing on the cops, although of course they're criminally liable and of course all four cops in Minneapolis should be charged and go to jail. And but it's very important that the movement that's arising sees beyond the cops and even the judicial system, because when I saw the uprising in Baltimore, there was almost no demands or slogans or people talking. I can't say none, but very little that went on beyond the visible signs of the coercive police state. The police state are coercive. They're brutal because they're asked to be. The elites that run the society, and frankly, a lot of ordinary people that are threatened by the violence that comes from neighborhoods that are very poor, including, I have to say, in Baltimore, much of the black working class neighborhoods, people who do work every day, and that's the majority of black Baltimore, go to work every day. They're not unemployed. Even though they understand the problem to a large extent of the poverty, they still want to be safe. So it's not as simplistic as just rich people telling cops to go beat up on poor people. Poor black people. It's also a lot of people are anxious and live in fear, but it's all the consequences of poverty. And that's what needs to be talked about. Not just restraining the police, certainly not just reviewing police forces, because we have to put on the table community control of police, not just review. But most importantly, and you just go talk to people in the poor neighborhoods in Baltimore, and I'm sure in other American cities, what do you want? And the answer is simple. They want jobs.
Let's talk about the rebellion against the police violence in the context of 40 million people being unemployed here in the U.S. and the dangerous pandemic that hasn't been adequately addressed. Do you think we're in for 3 or 4 or more years of depression coupled with a second wave of the spreading of this virus?
Well, I'm not an economist and I'm not a doctor, so I'll give you my best sense of having talked to economists and doctors. The answer is, yeah, I think we're in for at least 3-4 years. The vaccine seems to be at least 2-4 years away from being practically effective, even when there is an effective vaccine, and there still isn't. And it could be months and a year or more, or 2 years before there is. I know in many places, like right now, I happen to be in Canada because I'm a dual citizen. And when the COVID crisis broke out in New York, we went back to Canada. And the situation here, while it's much better because there's a public health care system, and the one thing people I don't think understand about the Canadian public health care system, it's not just about public health insurance. The hospitals are publicly owned, all the hospitals, with very rare exceptions, which gave the Canadians an ability to coordinate the resources better. Without that being said, there is no infrastructure here for manufacturing or distributing vaccine on a scale that's going to be meaningful for several years, and the same is situations in the United States. The economics of it, as far as I understand, is that the economy is in a death spiral. The bulk of the funding of the stimulus plan went to prop up big companies and indirectly the stock market, and maybe even directly the stock market. There's talk that the Fed is going to directly buy stock, but right now they're buying junk bonds and corporate debt, and there a lot of that corporate debt. And the reason why companies were in a precarious situation because of this closing down of production was they amassed enormous corporate debt by buying up their own stock. These stock buybacks, which were used to be illegal and were legalized, I believe, during the Clinton administration, they're just there to juice up the stock price and make money for the larger stockholders and the executives of these companies that got big bonuses because stocks went up. And it was a total smoke and mirror. But when you look at the amount of corporate debt, apparently the amount of corporate debt is almost equal in the dollar figure to the stock buybacks. And they're taking this money and relieving them, the corporations, of corporate debt that were the result of total manipulation. And that money's not going back into productive activity. The same thing with buying junk bonds The Fed is buying a little bit of state and city debt, but not nearly enough. The states and cities are in terrible, terrible shape. So what does it mean? It means this 40 million people that are unemployed, and it's probably going to be worse, they have almost no purchasing power. Now, they're getting a little bit of stimulus money. What is it, about $600-$700 a week for a few more weeks? If they were already on unemployment insurance, it got added to their unemployment insurance. I know in Maryland that amounts to about $1,000 a week. But that's not going to last very long. And it's not even enough to support a family for most people. So on the consumption side, the purchasing power side, the side that has to be strengthened if there's going to be an economic recovery, there's very little resources going into it. So how is there going to be a recovery? Well, I think the plan of the Republican Party and Trump and sections of the elites, corporate elites, is they think of this as, listen, every day people drive to work and get killed by cars. Does that mean we stop people from going to work and driving to work because some get killed by cars? So their logic is people will go to work and some are going to die of COVID-19, just the way they die from accidents. And maybe it will be in higher numbers. But the thing to understand about a country whose culture is rooted in slave society, to the extent to which that mentality still exists, that what is the whole point of racist ideology? It's to dehumanize those you exploit the most. Now, the elites in the United States, and it was so, and to some extent still is in England, but the early slaves were white. I mean, the British enslaved the Irish, and they dehumanized the Irish in order to enslave them. They also, if you look in the 19th century, child labor. Well, how did the elites justify child labor, kids going into mines at 8, 9 years old and dying of methane poisoning? Well, because they're not fully human, that's why. The dehumanization is not just about race, it's also about class. And the elites don't give a damn, really. When I say not all the elites, there are exceptions. But on the whole, the system doesn't care. They dehumanize white workers, and they dehumanize more Latino and black workers, because people of color are super exploited and get dehumanized even more. But their plan is, okay, some of these workers are going to die, but the economy will come back. They have the same attitude towards climate change. It's exactly the same mentality. The rich just think they're going to be okay. Their kids' kids will be okay. They don't want to think much further generationally than that. But they'll live in gated places. If they have to, they'll live up on hills. I mean, a lot of these rich people have, they bought land in New Zealand. They're making ways to get even in Ontario, where we are, there's a big buying up of land in cottage country in northern Ontario, where American elites are going to have retreats. So the same mentality that can look at, I just wrote an article about a guy named Rodney Todd, who's 5 years ago, he and his 7 children died of poisoning because they used a propane heater because he couldn't afford electricity. It's not like the elites don't know about this. They dehumanize people, and that's really what their plan for economic recovery is.
Well, let's talk about our demands. What do you think that people should be raising now? What sort of demands should people be putting forward?
Well, there's when I was in Baltimore, I used to talk about sort of 3 buckets. The first bucket is what can the community do on its own without anything from the political system. 2, what can you demand from the existing political system? Now, in Baltimore, and in fact, in many of the cities where all of this is exploding, it's the Democratic Party that runs the cities and, in many cases, the states. So this is in many cases, a fight with governments run by the Democratic Party. Not everywhere, but many places. And then the third bucket was what's a longer term vision for what people should demand and fight for. And I think it's very important we talk about all 3 of these type of demands now, because I think the movement gets very, the spontaneous movement especially, gets very locked into very, very short-term, narrow demand. For example, the primary demand right now in many of the protests is, you know, the general thing about Black Lives Matter. Yeah, but the truth is they actually don't matter to many of the elites, and they're not going to matter because of the demands of people in the streets. The reason Black lives don't matter, and I have to say poor blacks don't matter, because rich blacks' lives often do matter to the elites. I mean, basketball players, which are primarily black, not only get paid millions and millions of dollars, but the elites, you know, do it, their lives matter to the elites. I mean, it really is an economic thing in the final analysis. The, you know, black entertainers matter, but poor working class blacks don't matter. But they're not going to matter because people ask them to matter. The economics have to change. So what kind of demands? Well, first of all, let's just start with the issue of police violence, because it's an immediate thing that has to be dealt with. There's been a lot of talk, and it always comes back at these times, about civilian review boards of police. It's a model that doesn't work, and it shouldn't be a demand. The demand needs to be civilian control of police. And there's models like that. Detroit actually had a civilian management control board for a little while before the governor took over Detroit, and one of the first things he did was disband that. Toronto has a variation on it where the it's called a police management board, where they actually hire and fire the police. But it's not elected. It's not how the appointments are made are not democratic. But I think people need to demand democratically elected police management boards. And the community needs to hire and fire the police chief. It can't be up to the mayor through this management board. Now, this isn't going to change everything, because it's not going to change who owns stuff. It's not going to change where the real political power resides. But I think it is a way to start mitigating police violence. And if the community has a management board that will simply clean out the type of officers who repeatedly have these offenses and then get their, you know, continue to work in the police force. And the police forces are also extremely corrupt. There's one corruption scandal after another in the Baltimore case, and it's true in many of the big police forces, and including the police forces benefiting so much from the war on drugs. And that has to be broken, that link. And they benefit not only from the amount of overtime and jobs that are created in the war on drugs, which so devastates the communities. But the corruption is so rampant because the cops are so often interacting with drug gangs who bribe them and so on. And there's been a lot of these cases, again, in Baltimore, but right across the country. So community control of the police is an immediate demand. Then the heart of the problem is unemployment. There has to be demands about jobs, and it can't be just give us jobs, because it doesn't happen. It can't be about trying to instigate the private sector to hire more black workers or to hire in black communities. That policy has been tried over and over and over again, and all it does is funnel money to the private sector and never ends up in any kind of solution for unemployment in the inner cities. There has to be a public institution, publicly owned, that trains, hires, creates enterprises that actually compete with the private sector. They can be in the form of co-ops, but they need to be publicly funded. People have to start demanding publicly owned enterprises with a mission, public interest mission, which includes employment, training, but also provide actual services, create actual products. I know in Cleveland there's been some experimentation with this by creating worker co-ops where they created a cleaning business, and they made a deal with the city and some of the hospitals that were nonprofits that a certain percentage of the cleaning of the hospitals had to go to these worker co-ops. And those businesses, as I understand it, are still viable and have grown. That needs to be expanded on a much, much bigger scale. where you build public sectors of the economy, and you use the power of local government, state government, to do that. And that obviously requires the movement getting involved in electoral politics more than it has. And because right now, this, what's going on in the streets, a lot of the people who are so angry, the last thing they're thinking about is electoral politics. And partly because people are so disillusioned for such good reason with the Democratic Party that runs the cities that are in such a mess. But public ownership is the key to this, plus democratization of the politics. So a police management control board, democratically elected, that's a form of democratization. People getting involved in primarying these right-wing corporate Democrats. And in cities, you can also even run independents. You don't have to necessarily go through the Democratic Party. In Richmond, California, they elected a fairly progressive local city council, which then appointed a fairly progressive police chief. And they've been able to accomplish a certain amount of reforms. I don't think they've dealt with the issue of unemployment and developing a public sector nearly enough. But they certainly helped lower the murder rate and created a police force that was far more accountable to the community. So community control of the police, developing public sector employment at the level of cities, demanding that at the state level. And of course, at the national level, this election that's coming, I mean, it's likely Biden's going to win if there are elections. And I think it's a real question whether these elections are going to be postponed or not, either using the pandemic as an excuse, the quote-unquote riots in the streets as an excuse, or I'm very concerned about Trump begins a confrontation with Iran as another excuse to postpone the elections. But assuming there are elections, I think it's likely right now Biden will win. The movement, what's going on in the streets, has to become a more cohesive, conscious movement that makes demands of this Democratic Party administration, that you can't just be the liberal face of the billionaire class, which of course is what Biden has always been. Biden's claiming he wants to be the most progressive administration since Roosevelt. Well, there needs to be a movement on a national scale with a conscious leadership, and that leadership needs to be made up of working people, to a large extent, people of color, that demand significant structural reform and put tremendous pressure on Biden, that you see us in the streets now. Well, we can be back in the streets when you're president too, Mr. Biden. Because if you just are carrying on the policies of the Obama administration that helped create the greatest inequality gap in history and help set the table for the presidency of this fascist Trump, well, then we'll be back in the streets. So the movement really has to have a short-term, a medium, and a longer-term plan.
Paul Jay, we're come to the end of our allotted time here. I want to talk with you in the second segment about the existential threat of the nuclear situation. So before I say goodbye on this part, please tell listeners how they can reach you and how they can get a hold of your blog.
So they go to theanalysis.news. .com works too, but the name of the thing is theanalysis.news. And it's a website. And on the way, we do text articles, we do podcasts, video interviews. Sometime soon we'll be doing documentaries. Some of my documentaries are already up there. So theanalysis.news.
Thank you, Paul. You be safe. We'll continue this interview next week. Thank you so much, Paul Jay, for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. I want to tell somebody that my life I've seen a lot of things go down.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you would do until you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester.
Across 110th Street,
pushing won't let a junkie go free.
Across 110th Street,
boys are trying to catch a trick on the street.
Across 110th Street,
you can find it all. I don't mean to bother you, but I got one more thing I wanna say. Hey brother, there's a better way out. Snorting that coke, shooting that dope, man, you're copping out. Take my advice, it's either live or die. You gotta be strong, brother, if you wanna survive. You see, the family on the upper side of town will catch hell if a ghetto wasn't around. Every city, you find the same thing going down. Harlem is the capital of any ghetto town.
Across 110th Street,
pimps are trying to get your woman that sweet.
Across 110th Street,
push your coat, let a junkie go free.
Oh, across 110th Street,
boys are trying. Street, yeah.
Across 110th Street,
you can find it. Find it all in the street. Yes, you can. Yeah, 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 yeah. Do it again, just like a fish hooked on a line. Man's got his way, reeling you in a little at a time. Up on 110th Street, pimps are trying to catch a woman that's sweet. Wait a minute.